the show!
You have all made it through the dance. You have all made it nerdy.
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 77. I'm your host, John X. Thanks for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. This week's episode, we finally get out of the city and into the country a little bit. That's right, I go north, I go to Weld County, and we talk agriculture. It's high time I did this. I've been stuck in the city too long. And with my day job, I used to go out to Weld County all the time. I've probably been on nearly every county road in Weld County for a variety of reasons. And having done that for the last 5 years, I've cultivated quite the affection for the area because so much of what we do and what our lives depend on come from there. Weld County is one of the largest oil and gas producing counties in the entire country. And it's like the eighth largest ag producing county in the entire country as well. So food, energy, both come from there. And yet, living in the city and living the modern lives that we do, we're often disconnected from the very elements that make our society go. So this week's episode, I want to shed a little bit more light on that. Let's talk agriculture. Let's talk about where our food comes from. Let's talk food production. And this week's guest is Tom Herron. Tom Herron is someone that I've worked with for the last 5 years in sort of oblique capacities. And you know, we would intersect. We never worked directly on a project directly related to his business, but we were both sort of keen on various issues in Weld County, and we would end up intersecting that way through trade associations and whatever. And he is the CEO of Ag Professionals. Now, what that means is that while he's not a producer himself, while he doesn't raise cattle, he doesn't operate a dairy, he doesn't raise hogs, he doesn't raise wheat, he doesn't do the production of agriculture, of farming, he does work with those folks. He helps get their sites permitted. He finds them land. He helps them navigate the regulatory environment. And so he is intimately connected to all things agriculture and has been his entire life. He talks a little bit about growing up in North Carolina and raising tobacco and things like that. Normally, I like to do a lot more biography of my guests and talk about their journey and how they got to where they are. But this week, God bless him, Tom just sort of jumped right into the issues with me because in our age of social media, we see a lot about agriculture, but I think we understand very little. You'll see a news story that goes viral about people mistreating animals in some sort of agricultural facility. And your brain sort of immediately goes, oh no, I hope that's not how the entire industry works. But, you know, maybe it is. And you're afraid. I certainly am. You go, oh man, I hope that's not like widespread. I hope that's not a common practice. I hope mistreating animals isn't just the way of things. And so I talked to Tom about that. We spend a bunch of time in this podcast talking about animal welfare. And we talk about regulations and the impact of regulations and how we know more now than we did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, and how the industry has evolved. We also spend some time talking about GMOs. That's right. We talk GMOs. So if that's a topic that's been in your Facebook feed, I know it's certainly been in mine. This is an episode that's going to be of interest to you. We also talk about urban sprawl and how that's impacted agriculture. You know, you come at it from a certain angle, hearing what you've heard, maybe seeing what you've seen. You've seen news stories. You're on your social media pages. And, you know, you'll see things about animal welfare or GMOs or urban sprawl or whatever. And then you come at it from his side. And he said, you know, how do you sit down with people? And we talk about shared values. It's a fantastic conversation. And whatever your disposition is here, whether you're a huge champion of conventional farming, we also talk about that, by the way. We talk about factory farms versus family farms. You know, what the reality is versus perception and what has led to the rise of consolidation and vertical integration. It was incredibly illuminating for me. And so I cannot thank Tom enough for taking the time to dig into these issues with me. We also talk about farm to table. We talk about people getting closer to the means of production and what that means for the future of agriculture. And it's episodes like this that really get me jazzed up. Because again, whether you agree with Tom or whether, you know, maybe you don't, I don't know what your disposition is. It is whatever it is. Getting first-person narrative from someone who works this industry every day, I think is incredibly valuable. It's one of the best ways to have increased understanding of anything which is at the very heart of why I do this podcast. So I would hold this episode up as an episode that I'm incredibly proud of, because here's an issue that's important. And here is a person who works that issue every day. How do we feed the country? How do we feed the world? And all of the things that go into that, whether it's animal welfare, whether it's GMOs, whether it's urban sprawl, whether it's any issue associated with agriculture, Tom has dealt with it and has worked with it and worked on it for the last two decades. Ag professional has been in business for 20 years, and we talk about how it came to be and exactly what they do. And it's a great story. So I adore this episode. Tom Herron is just a very sincere, very thoughtful, very incisive man. And it was a real treat to get to sit down with him in his office for an hour. I think you'll get a lot out of it. I think you're really going to enjoy it. So stay tuned for that. A couple of quick items. Facebook and Twitter are always on for the John of All Trades podcast. Check us out on Facebook. It's J-O-A-T pod. You can also search John of All Trades. And on Twitter, it's twitter.com/J-O-A-T pod. Search for us in iTunes and Stitcher. You can subscribe there. Every new episode, as soon as it's posted, will be delivered right to you. If you're there, please give us a rating and a review. And you know what? Share it. Share it with the people that you know. Help spread the word of the John of All Trades podcast, because it's episodes like this that I hope get more exposure and lead to increased education and understanding for us all. So if you have an idea for a guest, someone I haven't talked to, what do you want to learn more about? Hit me up. Facebook and Twitter are good ways to do that. Or you can find us at the website, johnofalltrades.us. That's J-O-N of all trades.us. But for now, this week's episode is all about ag. We've got Tom Herron, the CEO of Ag Professionals. Check out their website, agpros.com, A-G-P-R-O-S.com. And you know what? Let's learn about the food that we all eat. How does it get produced? What are the issues associated with it? We spend nearly an hour talking about it. So this week's episode, number 77, Tom Herron, starts right now.
We have primarily land use hearings that we're working on in Weld County this week, but we work throughout Colorado and surrounding states. Actually, we're licensed in 12 different states in the western U.S.
Doing so, when you say land use, is that your company is Ag Professionals? So who are the types of clients that you work with?
Well, we work with all types of rural clients, primarily agriculture, ag production, dairies, feedlots, pork facilities, poultry. We've done a few emus and ostriches and racetracks and interesting things like that. But also we do a lot of commercial and industrial that comes from our rural areas or rural clients.
Okay, so how big are we talking? I mean, what size of farms and dairies are we talking about here?
Well, we work with all family farms and different types of farms from a couple hundred head, or a good example is some goat dairies, goat cheese specialty products, yeah, things like that, all the way up to families that have, you know, six or eight different dairies averaging about 3,000 cows each, 50 or 100,000 head feedlots. So all the way,
it runs the gamut is what you're describing.
Pretty much in rural America or agriculture, yes.
Okay, perfect. So sitting here in your office with Tom Herron, the CEO of Ag Professionals, thanks for being here.
Not a problem.
I really appreciate the time, because this is an issue that I've become close to, having worked in Weld County for as long as I have. You work collaboratively and sort of obliquely with the ag industry. I've never done work directly for ag, but it's something that there are a lot of issues similar, because when I worked in energy, people don't know where their energy comes from. And I would say your average citizen doesn't know where their food comes from. Would you agree?
I would agree. It's funny, and knowing you as long as I have in the oil and gas, the opposite has happened to me. Being in agriculture, our clients own a lot of property.
Okay.
And by default, if you're in Weld County,
right,
you've got either pipelines or oil and gas across your property. And just being in the same proximity, we have garnered some business from oil and gas companies or industrial, but all of a rural nature that still fit with our mission at Ag Professionals.
Weld County is really sort of a unique place to do business, because it's responsible for so much oil and gas production in the state. and then so much ag, too.
Well, Weld County is the eighth largest agricultural county in the country, I believe.
Wow, really?
I'm trying to remember my statistics here. I think we're one of the largest agricultural counties outside of California.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
So we're the largest gross receipt county in Colorado for sure. So there's a lot going on in our backyard, but we do work all throughout the western U.S.
So give me the elevator pitch for ag professionals, because you guys are not a dairy yourselves. You're not producers, right?
We are a contract developer. You know, I believe it's, is it 3M commercials that says, we don't make the products you buy, right. We make the products you buy better.
Okay.
We don't grow the food you eat. We help the producers that make your food.
Okay. And how do you help them?
Well, as a contract developer, they have an idea for a project. They'll come to us, whether that's relocation, finding land, expanding, buying, selling, improving their operation. And we're kind of a one-stop shop. So when you walk into Ag Professionals, we can help you find land. We can permit it, design it, engineer it, do the construction management,
Wow. Almost
turnkey it. And at the end of the day, at the end of our schedule, you've got your project.
So here's your project. I heard someone describe a different part of the business in oil and gas as you're almost out there building highways. So you're laying the groundwork so that someone can come in and do what they do, but with a minimum amount of headaches. Is that right?
That's correct. It is our client's project, but we develop it, but it's their money and it's their project, and they're the operator.
Excellent. How long have you guys been in business?
Well, in February, we will be starting our 20th year.
20 years?
Yes.
Congratulations. That's fantastic.
Oh, it is exciting. When I look back, it seems quick. I can't believe it's been 20 years.
Right.
But we're pretty proud of that fact.
And you founded it, correct?
I did, yes.
Okay. When you started, was it just you?
Actually, this was an offshoot of the Colorado Cattle Feeders Association back in the 90s, and a gentleman named Jim Anderson, who used to be in Longmont. Environmental regulations were just kind of kicking off in the agricultural industry, and the Livestock Association thought that they should have an environmental committee, and I happened to join and be involved in the environmental committee when they were talking about hiring an environmental staff person.
Right.
Of course, I raised my hand.
Yeah, right.
And I was involved in voting on my own position's creation at the Livestock Association. So
well played, sir.
it was a good fit. It worked very well. After a couple of years, we saw the need for a lot more involvement. Of course, when you're a nonprofit trade association crossing over with consulting, there's some liability and issues there. So we looked at creating a separate entity owned by the Livestock Association, which again was a good idea in theory, but a for-profit owned by a nonprofit board of farmers that change every year is just kind of a tough way to run a business.
That makes good sense. And so as you got started, because it was founded sort of under the nonprofit umbrella, was it kind of an easy sell? Because it sounds like it sort of came out of need. Were you able to hit the ground running at that point? Or were you kind of running uphill?
Well, we were kind of running uphill because the environmental regulations and the development of those, it was all new. And when we're talking to cattle feeders and dairymen, we've been dealing with lagoons and stormwater runoff and EPA and these things for 20 years. But, you know, 20 years ago, it's kind of new.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd tell people, here's some changes in the industry. Here's some things that we're going to be facing. And, you know, you get that, what are you talking about look, or you're half crazy look, or
this isn't going to be a big deal. Like you're overstating things. The sky is falling kind of thing, right?
Well, I've noticed, because I've worked in the environmental industry before I started Ag Professionals, and regulations go through a maturing process, I call it.
Okay.
And the regulated community goes through a maturing process, too. Kind of works like this. When the regulations are brand new, you know, people kind of say, oh, that doesn't affect me, or kind of lay low and nobody will notice, or
yeah,
ignore
we'll fly
it
under the radar, sure.
Yeah. So you go through this denial stage. It's almost like grieving. You go through the anger stage where you are fighting the regulations.
And I can't believe they're going to pass these. It's going to put us out of business.
Exactly.
Right?
You've seen it in the oil and gas. So
you're
down at the state health department. You're at the Water Quality Control Commission, the Air Quality Control Commission. You know, you're lobbying at the legislature. And that's part of the maturation process of the regulations, and I think it's proper because you're kind of working out the kinks. It's good for the industry. It's good for the regulators. Then you go in from denial and anger into reluctance.
Yeah.
Saying, okay, yeah, I'm going to do something, but I'm going to do as little as possible.
Right.
To accepting it and working with it. You know, what's interesting is, as things evolve, what I see in industries, and the same thing's happening with oil and gas, once you go through the maturation process of the regulations and the, five stages of grieving in the industry, you actually find that the industry and the regulators begin working on it together.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see how that matures, but that is the final stage, and it's very apparent in oil and gas. It's very apparent in agriculture right now. The industry and the communities and the regulators, we work together a lot more than we butt heads.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we need the products that the ag industry is providing. We also need some rules, some common sense rules governing those. Are you finding that does the industry as a whole end up paying for the bad actors? Because there are going to be bad actors, and I've found when you're working energy, you're only ever as good as your worst operator. Is that true in ag too?
It is, and yes, we see the industry paying for the what you call bad actors. I think in terms, most everything on a bell curve.
Sure.
You've got the initiators, the ones that are typically ahead of the curve, but the majority are in the curve.
Sure.
And you got a few that are lagging behind the curve, but they're all on the same line, and they're all paying for it. You know, it's funny. I never would be put in a position to say I'm an advocate for regulations, but,
right.
You know, for home builders, for example, when you're looking at building permits or building construction standards and you're building to the requirements mm-hmm. and a competitor is not, you're at a competitive disadvantage because they are doing substandard work and able to get their product out at a lower cost,
right.
Lower overhead, but at a much larger future expense. So, you know, I think some regulation is reasonable.
Of course. I mean, you don't want to make the rules so onerous that no one can afford to do business. But I think having some guide rails, some side rails, is probably prudent. Is that sort of what you're describing?
And I wish we didn't have to, but you're right. There is a small percentage that everyone pays for, and a good example of that's animal welfare.
Okay.
You know, I think the general public would think that larger size agriculture doesn't care about our animals, and that's just absurd. Our clients, you know, love their animals. It's their livelihood. You've really got to have a passion for an animal industry and animal husbandry to do it as long and be as successful as these our families are. But you do see bad actors out there. And they just shouldn't be in the business or handling animals. But that is such a tiny fraction. But what the public sees is they think because of media now,
right.
And instant media, that's how the industry operates. And that is just so far from the truth.
So talk a little bit more about that. I think everyone has seen, you know, a story of animals not being treated well at what might be referred to in the lexicon as big factory farms. How do you turn around that perception? And can you describe sort of what the process is actually like compared to, say, a viral news story that people have shared on their Facebook wall?
Well, I don't know if you've heard of a company called Edelman, but they do a lot of public opinion tracking.
Mm-hmm.
And some of their recent work says only 47% of the population agrees with the statement that farming is performed in a responsible way.
Okay.
And that was shocking, and that less than that agree U.S. farmers take good care of the environment. But we're in the environmental business. When you're in agriculture, you are in the environmental business. And what I think happens is we have become so far removed from agriculture.
Right.
You know, I think our generation, you know, for me, I was directly involved in it, but most of my generation, I think, it was probably their parents or grandparents that were involved in agriculture. So my kids' generation or their kids' generation is now, you know, they probably never even saw it except driving by down the road.
Right.
The way that people eat now, the majority of people, well, I was looking for some stats here, but our population is changing. Almost half of the adult eating occurs alone. Almost half of the food expenditures are away from home, which means you're going to a restaurant or a drive-thru. So how much you think about your food, I will tell you people really want to know about what's in their food.
Okay. So like a company like Chipotle will make sort of big statements about the way that their chickens are raised, you know, hormone-free, free-range, organic, all that. I would say there's increasing attention on that. Is that concern, is that real? Is that misplaced? Because you're seeing a lot more attention being paid to it.
Well, that's marketing.
Okay.
They're generating buzz. They're generating a sensation. It's like a newspaper headline. It's like, let's see if we can create something sensational so our name will get out there more and more. I know in politics, there's an old saying that, you know, name recognition is most important at the ballot box, whether it's good name recognition or bad name recognition. And Chipotle likes to see their name out there a lot.
Sure. It's a brand proposition for them. What is the reality? What is the difference between what they're espousing and is there actual differentiation between, you know, what they're claiming and how the vast majority of our food is actually produced?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, when we're dealing with people that aren't as familiar with agriculture, school kids, tours, in our public hearings, what we're finding out is people just crave stories and knowledge about how we produce our food. They're just intrigued by it. So when we actually get them out on a farm and actually have them talking with a producer, they're just shocked. They're like, this is nothing like what I was told, or this is nothing like what I was led to believe. A lot of people get their information now instantly from social media and peer groups. You know, I think when you look at some of the recent issues surrounding, immunizations and autism, most of the information and the sources that people trust are from their peer groups of other moms. Not, people are very distrustful of government, actually even more than industry. Because I thought it was funny now, you familiar with the butter craze going on right now?
Mm-mm.
McDonald's is going to be switching over completely to butter. And what has our government done? You know, they said butter was bad for you, and everyone was eating margarine, and now trans fats are bad for you, but saturated fats and some things they're saying are better for you. So now we went from don't eat butter to eat butter to saccharins, going to cause cancer to what causes high blood pressure. Meat is bad. Meat is good. You know, the public has just been batted around on this stuff with science for, 50 years, so they don't put a lot of stock in what the government puts out.
Right. So what is the truth, Tom? Because I think there's a comic named Lewis Black. He had a joke. He was doing a joke about health, and he put it to the audience, and he said, is milk good or bad? And, people in the audience shouted out, yes, no, hey, some of it. And he goes, I rest my case. No one knows. So, I mean, how do you sort of cut through all that noise? And you've been an ag your whole life. Where does the truth actually lie?
Well, first of all, milk is good.
Okay, good.
But everything is on the edges. Everything is sensationalized. You see extremists on both sides of the spectrum, whether it's a food issue, an animal welfare issue, whether it's a political issue. I know that you've been involved in some of the local politics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you see extreme rhetoric on both sides. I grew up, I was taught moderation. If you do any one thing too much, it's probably not going to be good for you, whether that's having a beer or eating meat or eating vegetables. You need to have balance in your life.
Or even watching TV or playing video games, working.
Social media, texting, any of this stuff,
right?
Not in moderation. I guess that's where I'm at, is you got to have balance in your diet. You got to have balance in your life. You got to have some reasonableness. I mean, if you sat there and I know probably some frat kid dare did this, but I don't see if you sat there and tried to eat stick after stick after stick of butter, I'm sure you wouldn't feel very good.
Probably not.
That doesn't mean the butter's bad for you at all. So moderation and common sense. I think we get really away from common sense. I tell my staff all the time when we're looking at some of the stories that pop up, media in almost any form is first and foremost trying to sell something.
Right. Okay.
They are wanting to either get ad revenue. I know my sister was in network news for a long time, and we had this discussion at many Christmas and Thanksgivings to finally admit that the news stories were to be attention-grabbing so they would get their ratings numbers, so they would get the best advertising and raise more money.
Right.
There's something about sensationalism.
There's never any stories about the planes that land.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. But you know, I'm glad. Here's something that I remember. It's funny. How many sermons should I have remembered growing up? There is one that I have always remembered.
Okay.
Because one of my pastors growing up was talking about negativity and the news. You know, you have all these murders and rapes and bad things, and it just seems like they're coming at you daily, the one bad thing after another. He reminded us that bad things are news because they're rare.
Right.
They're supposed to be rare. And this was probably 30 years ago. He said, what we need to watch out for is when you start seeing good things and human interest stories and somebody taking care of somebody else or somebody helping out or donating, and that becomes news. That's when we got to watch out, because those are becoming rare, that our public's becoming desensitized. Imagine that when we start having newscasts about the planes that land.
Yeah, right.
What kind of problems do we have? So I've always put it in perspective that these industry videos and things are such a tiny fraction. They are so rare. And you don't see stories about how well our animals are taken care of, because that's the majority. They're taken very well care of, and that's not interesting news, but that is the fact.
So let me ask you then. So because the negative stories get so much attention, has that served as a catalyst to the industry to say, hey, you know what, we should educate more about what we do? Because you mentioned having kids, you know, school-age kids out to farms, and their minds are blown. Does that serve to sort of galvanize the ag industry to say, hey, you know what, if we're not telling our own story, someone else is telling it for us, and this is the story they're telling?
That part is true. It is getting the information out and telling your story, but It's not just telling your story, because one of the things that ag has been notorious for is when people have concerns or fears about their food or something in our industry, what normally happens? You parade out a bunch of facts. You parade out a scientist. That's what's got the government where nobody trusts them.
Okay.
Is they've done all this research and they say, yep, don't worry. Don't be afraid. This is good for you. And actually, what is the reality in just any people from ag to urban to anything in between is sitting down and talking and letting them know you have shared values.
Yeah, okay.
That is actually the most important thing. And I think even some of the oil and gas discussion you've been involved in, you know, we have shared values. We live right there at our facilities. We see our animals every day. People in oil and gas, they live in these communities. Their kids are going to these schools, you know. And when you actually sit with people and get, if you can cut past everything to sit down and get to the shared values,
mm-hmm.
that's when you can really start having a conversation and people realize, you know, you're not a big bad guy that's trying to do this.
You're not twirling your mustache. Right.
And I'm not sitting there going, wow, you're so radical, we can't have a rational discussion, because
right.
once you start with the shared values, then you can start having a dialogue about, okay, what can we do here?
Well, what you're describing to me is not only having shared values, saying, I live in this community, I care about the health and welfare of this community, but also people have heard what they've heard, and people are entitled to be wrong, right? They can be wrong. You can say, you've heard this about the entirety of the ag industry. We're talking about animal welfare, right? You've seen what you've seen. Mm-hmm. And you can say, that's not true of the entirety of the industry, but you've heard what you've heard. So what I'm saying is, people have a right to be wrong, but it doesn't mean that they're crazy. So acknowledging that, hey, you have fears about this, and your fears are very real because it's what you've heard. You haven't heard everything, but it's what you've heard. So I acknowledge that you've heard that what you've seen, yes, it does exist. But I'm here to tell you that it's not true of the entirety of our industry.
Well, and again, you've got to start by recognizing that you're not going to fight fear with science.
Right.
And that's so much what the industry has done in the past. And, you know, there's a thing kind of called bad news bias.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to weigh more heavily on people's decisions than positive information. I think some of the statistics go one item of negative information can wipe out five positive pieces of information. Negative information more strongly influences people's attitude, and negative information is a lot more enduring. I mean, it's just, it's like what you said, there's not news stories about a plane landing.
Right.
It's just in our subconscious. You expect it to land.
Right.
And you expect that it operates in a certain way. And when it does, you're not surprised.
Right.
So people expect that we take care of our animals. People expect that we operate in a certain way.
And I think to people's credit, they're offended when that sort of expectation, when that generally held perception is shattered by a negative story. I think people necessarily go, whoa, wait a minute. This is not how I understand this industry to operate. And I'm offended by that.
Yep.
Is this, and people, I don't think, want it to be true of the industry at large.
There's a little something that I think in any business, particularly in the food business, and it's called social license.
Yep, social license to operate.
Social license to operate. And that is, again, with some shared values and expectations that your actions are not just serving the best interest of you. You're serving the best interest of the people you work for. You're serving the best interest of the people you work with. Like here, you know, it's our clients, it's our employees, but it's also, you know, our cooperators and government agencies, and it's also the communities that we're in. I know some of the projects we do, some of the communities, you know, may not be the happiest with the outcome of our projects, but I think when you look at the balance, that the processes we go through in talking with the community and working with the regulators, the mitigation that goes on in the development of our types of projects is substantial. And I guess that's a way of saying a dairy operation that we would permit and build today is nothing like one that we saw or ran 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
In what way? Describe it to me.
Well, again, we were in more isolation. We did things that we thought were right and that we felt were right. But as time goes on, we found ways to do things better.
Right.
I mean, even when you talk about whether you're into believing it or not, global warming and greenhouse gases, I mean, just take the fact that in the last 40 or 50 years, we're producing twice as much milk with half the cows.
Wow.
So think about that. If you think on just one dairy, wow, that's a big dairy. I think the average dairy we permit now is probably 2,000 or 3,000 cows, and some people go, wow, that's a big dairy.
Right.
When you look at the production efficiency and the carbon footprint and the environmental impact, 50 years ago, we had twice as many cows, and they were producing half as much milk.
Mm-hmm.
So our footprint has shrunk dramatically.
Is that due to technology, better methods, is a greater understanding? How do you achieve efficiencies like that?
Multiple things. It's better animal husbandry. It's taking care of the animals' nutrition,
okay,
genetics. You know, when you look at cows out on pasture, cows, well, if you could talk to a cow, yeah, there are days when it is just gorgeous, just like today. You know, it's a beautiful fall day.
It's a lovely day.
You want to be outside, and if you're laying in the grass, you're just thrilled.
Right.
But there are also days when that cow is just burning up.
Or it's windy and raining.
Or it's windy and raining,
snowing,
or snowing.
Cold, yeah.
So we design facilities so that the animals are very comfortable. You know, our facility designs are to protect the animal, to shelter the animal, to have good, clean feed in front of them all the time.
So it's to optimize comfort, because cows with better disposition tend to produce better. Is that what you're describing?
That is correct. So one
thing I want to come back to that I was interested in, you said previously dairies were more isolated. How big an issue is urban sprawl for you all to deal with?
It is fairly dramatic.
Okay.
Because the things that we need in agriculture are the same things that the urban populations need. I know when I do a lot of community meetings, first thing people say is, we're not opposed to agriculture. We all like to eat. Second thing they say is, but we wish you'd go somewhere else.
And NIMBY, and, right? Not in my backyard.
Yes.
I mean, that's
but
kind
I want to give them a little. I want to give them a little more credit than that because you know they say go somewhere else. What they don't understand is if we could go out in the middle of you know of a desert somewhere where. And things would work if that was an option, but we need the same things that the urban development needs. You know, we need good clean water.
Mm-hmm.
We need roads for market transportation. We need employees.
Yeah.
We need infrastructure. We need utilities.
Yeah.
We need labor. You know, proximity to market. Agriculture. We're shipping perishable product. We're shipping fresh food and raw products that, have to get to market. So, we kind of hear urban sprawl. Well, at Ag Professionals, it's I joke about it, but I guess it's not a joke. I want to see agricultural sprawl. I want to see agricultural encroachment. But, it's the opposite side of the same coin. We all need the same things. But when I say I want to give them a little more credit than just being NIMBYs, again, you've got to look at your social license to operate.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to look at your shared values. And you said, what's different now?
Yeah.
50 years ago, it was the old Soil Conservation Service, but now it's the NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service. Some of their old guidance back in the 40s and 50s
mm-hmm.
actually encouraged and helped farmers and told them to locate their confined feeding and their pens and things on stream banks because you had slope and they drained and you were near water for livestock water.
Yeah.
But also so you had a way to get rid of the animal manures.
Wow. And that's clearly not a best practice anymore.
Absolutely not. But it's the same reason people have distrust of government. You know, they said don't eat margarine or don't eat butter, eat margarine.
Right.
And what it is that wrong? Well, at the time, you can't say it's wrong. But when you look back 50 years, all it is we've learned. And when you say, how do we get more production out of half the cows?
Right.
We're all learning.
Yeah, you're using the best available knowledge of the time. Speaking about urban sprawl, you'll hear more about sort of urban farming. You know, there are people keeping chickens in urban environments. And, I heard the term not that long ago, agriburbia.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on sort of the movement of people almost bringing agriculture into the city and into their homes?
Well, first of all, I love it from the standpoint that anything that gets people closer to their food and understanding.
So this whole farm to table movement too, with like restaurants saying we get our food from this farm. Like I think of a restaurant downtown called Beast and Bottle that will buy two animals a week or a day or whatever it is. I don't know how it works. And then that's as much meat as they have for that day.
Yep.
You're a fan of that.
I'm a fan of anything that gets people closer to their food.
Cool. Okay.
And it takes all kinds. There's not any one best production way. How you would produce or design a dairy in Florida is different than how you would design a dairy in Washington State.
Sure.
But the fact that it's getting, again, more people closer to their food. Hey, if they're just sticking their hands in dirt and getting their hands dirty and seeing what it feels like and knowing what good soil feels like and organic base that you're growing something from that's natural is better than going through the grocery store and just thinking that's where your eggs come from.
Right.
So, people that raise chickens in their backyard find out how hard it is to raise chickens.
Right.
And how hard it is to get eggs and deal with all the issues that you have to deal with. So I'm an advocate of that. But I will say...
That's not going to work for everyone, though.
No, it's not. And I'm not going to start a discussion on picking apart organic or natural or conventional. Hey, we all need food, and we're supposed to have, 9 billion people on the planet by 2050?
Right.
I can say that if we're going to double the population and feed everybody, we're not going to do it with rooftop gardens.
Yeah.
But the fact that they have rooftop gardens in New York or Chicago or they're plowing up blocks in Detroit to farm things, should we stop doing that because that alone is not going to feed people? Absolutely not. But we see the choice we have in America with organic and natural and the discussion on GMOs and gluten and things of a more affluent society. My wife, Cindy, just got back from Africa, and it wasn't a tourist trip. She went with the Global Livingston Institute to Rwanda and Uganda. Nobody there was worried about gluten. They're just worried about eating.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And in order to feed twice the population, it's going to take technology. It's
right.
going to take genetic modification. GMOs, I kind of find it interesting every time I go through the airport and I see somebody with the – have you seen the little dog carrier purse, you know, with the super tiny toy
right.
animal of some kind? That's a very genetically modified dog that they're carrying around in that purse.
Yeah, very selective breeding, right?
It is. And we're doing the same thing, except now we're doing it at the genetic level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no different than research we're doing at the genetic level for cancer treatment and other treatment of human maladies that we all want to solve. But CSU came up with wheat varieties that are extremely drought tolerant. Mm. You know, that was great in Colorado, but that's exceptional in places like Africa.
Yeah.
You know, where people are just worried about eating. They're not worried that CSU developed a drought-tolerant wheat and whether they should be making bread with it or not. We need to expand our horizons. One of the things that Cindy said when she came back from the trip was taking a trip like that, it puts it in perspective. Little things that used to bother you,
yeah.
little things that you thought mattered a lot,
right,
don't matter as much anymore when you go there and see that kind of stuff. So
people are struggling for clean water and something to eat.
Exactly.
Yeah, I follow you.
And China gets a lot of press, but Africa actually has the biggest opportunity for agriculture. That is the largest remaining arable, farmable land base in the world.
Wow.
There is tons of opportunity there. A lot of it is not developed, obviously, because of government instability and finance, not the land or the technology.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Africa is, you know, we started in our backyard, ag professionals, started in my basement.
Yeah.
You know, we started doing projects for some friends and agriculturalists that were within a 10-mile radius. And before my career is done, I would really like to be doing things more like developing food for people in Africa.
Doing it on a global scale.
Yes.
So I want to touch on GMOs just a bit, because you hear a lot of discussion on GMOs and a lot of people afraid by what they've heard, maybe what they've read. How has that discussion influenced the way you all do business? Is that a consideration? You go into a new community, you want to site a new facility, and people go, are you guys doing GMOs? Has that entered the discussion more?
In our business, we're primarily more in the proteins and
okay.
the animals. And that was funny. It crops up.
I thank you.
It crops up occasionally, but you see it a lot in corn and wheat and vegetables, fruits, things like that. We don't do a lot in those industries. We do work with some green industries in developing greenhouses and certain items like that. But
I'm sure when it comes to livestock, though, and live animals, people are concerned about what those animals are being fed, though. Is that part of it?
You know, that can be part of it. I know that there is a certain faction that looks at not just GMO-free bread, but, you know, are the animals being fed that? But, you know, I look for the middle ground. You're going to find extremists on any side of the issue. But what agriculture has done and what science has done is just short of miraculous with how we're able to produce so much more with so much less. We actually have much smaller footprint, much smaller impact, and feed a whole lot more people than we ever did before. It's just amazing when you really take the time to put down the rhetoric and look into it.
So basically what you're describing to me is, in your estimation, the discussion has gotten sort of out of hand a little bit when it comes to GMOs in terms of what they've done and what their actual impact is. How do we get back or how do we evolve the discussion to be a little bit more nuanced and understanding them?
You know, I think we get tunnel vision. We're in a very affluent society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we walk around with blinders on, and we're worried about every little thing when our average lifespan has been increased dramatically. Our birth rate's been increased dramatically because, you know, we just live better and we live healthier, so that now we're even to the point of getting into some of these minute discussions. It's funny. I think I was in the airport. Can't remember what food service establishment. They had a big sign on the wall, and I think it was three sentences long. It was like non-GMO, gluten-free,
certified
organic, natural, yeah. Certified, you know, and we pet our cows and it was this big, huge, long
night,
description,
yeah.
And I think I was trying to find a bottle of water. You see that in an affluent society. I think if we got out of our subdivisions where we're, you know, drive half a mile to a grocery store and, you know, drive under a couple of miles for the kids to school, and, you know, if we take a vacation, we're going to some place that's pleasant, recreational. But if you get out of that and go see something like Cindy did in Africa, that can change the discussion itself. See what is really out there, what needs to be done. What can be done, and all the tools that we have available to us, I think we ought to use. Now, 30 years from now, just like locating feedlots on creek banks, you know, 50 years ago was a guidance from the government. We may look back in 30 years and know more than we do now. But if we're not availing all the tools that we have right now, we're really coming up short.
Well, and if someone wishes to eat GMO-free, they certainly have the options to do that now.
They do.
Which, you know, is more power to them. It's interesting because, you know, this is an industry that, again, it's what we all eat. Tom, where do you see, having been in this, you said you grew up on a farm, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did you guys do there?
Well, interesting. I grew up in North Carolina and Tennessee, and we raised cattle. We raised hay. We had chickens. We had a hog. We had big gardens, and that was all for us to eat. But what my family did for money was we raised tobacco.
Yeah, okay.
Both sides of my family were tobacco farmers, and as you know, what all has happened with the tobacco and cigarettes and things like that, the government's pretty much bought out all of the tobacco allotments. They used to have quota for it.
Huh.
And, you know, I was in North Carolina and Georgia not too long ago, and you can still find a tobacco patch here and there, but you hardly see it at all.
I mean, tobacco's damn near criminalized at this point.
You know, the way that it's been handled and treated is it is damn near criminalized, which is unfortunate because we turn around and make marijuana legal in Colorado. So it's really confusing to me.
Right.
To have legal marijuana and walk down the sidewalk in Longmont, you can't even be out in public with a cigarette in downtown Longmont. I saw a street sign that said, you know, no public smoking. I just think that's really ironic.
It's certainly an odd juxtaposition. My question is, having been in this industry your entire life, having grown up on a farm, and now worked in the industry almost your entire life. I was reading up a little bit on you. You also went to CSU for a time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Ram as well, which is fantastic. You served in the Army. Thank you for your service. And having worked in agriculture for so long, where do you see it going from here? Look into the crystal ball a little bit. How is agriculture going to look 10 years from now, 20 years from now? I know you can't say with any authority, but given the evolution you've seen up to now, where do we go from here? We have 9 billion people on this planet by 2050, and we have to feed everyone.
You know, I'll talk about American agriculture first, and then I'll try and talk on a global scale.
Sure.
You know, I have had the luxury of looking back on my experiences for the last 20 or 30 years, and there's a huge debate about, you know, family farm, and you hear people throw out, and it's meant to be derogatory, factory farm and corporate farm, and it's meant to be derogatory, and it's not, because all we work with are family farms.
Mm-hmm.
And just because, you know, Adam Dairy with three generations on there is milking, you know, 400 or 500 cows, they're still in an LLC or an S corp or something like that, because that's the, you know, with American legal issues and liability and tax structures, you know, you go start a business, whether you're doing a scrapbooking business or a lawn mowing business, you form a company. You know, they are all companies, but most everything and everyone we work with is our families. They're people. You know, corporate entity that is this big box computer that we just work for or work with. Everything and everyone we work with, You know, it's a people business. And really, that's the reason I'm in it and have loved it so long is all the people that we work with and get to know. When we develop a project, sometimes, it takes 3 or 4 years to develop. And by the time we're done, we know the families, we know the kids, we get invited to graduations and weddings. And, you know, that's very rewarding. But in our economy, I know we started out the topic of regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Agriculture is a business where, let's say you're in business class at CSU. You brought up CSU. So
sure.
Let's say you're in business class and your professor gives you an assignment to go think up a business and bring a report back to class. And you come back to class with a business idea that you're familiar with a profit and loss statement, P&L,
yeah, sure.
An income sheet. So you come back to class and you tell your professor, hey, I got this great business. I'm going to do it. It's going to take like millions and millions and millions of dollars of capital. It's going to require me to work 24/7, 365. Oh, and I have absolutely no control over the income side of my P&L, my income statement.
Okay.
The only thing I can manage are all of the expenses.
Okay.
Your professor is going to look at you like you're crazy, number one, and you're probably going to get an F for your business plan.
Okay.
But in agriculture, you know, we do not have a lot of control over the income statement on the income side.
Right.
So you've heard economies of scale and things are getting larger because the only thing we can manage our business on is the costs. If we could get what milk would be worth if we were making a piece of furniture with a markup that we go retail in a store somewhere.
Right.
But we can't.
Right.
Same thing with wheat, same thing with corn, same thing with beef, just about anything. So
you got to get cracking on that weather machine too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we've got a perishable product. We're
right.
subject to Mother Nature. And your professor is going to look at you and go, what? Well, you must be in Colorado because marijuana is legal. So what were you smoking when you did this assignment? But where is agriculture going? When you can only really control the expenses, you have to learn to be very efficient. And where agriculture is going, it's funny that the government and the people that want to control agriculture and put more regulations on agriculture to ensure whatever their picture of the American Gothic, the family farm, the typical red barn, you know, chickens in the yard. When you put more and more regulations and more pressure on it, they're actually driving agriculture to get bigger and get more efficient and causing some of the smaller operations to go out. Because I know what it costs for some of our services when, you know, the things that we have to develop to comply with regulations for our clients. I see it month after month. A lot of our clients are saying, you know, I'm 60-some years old. I think the average age anyway is like 58 in agriculture. But
wow.
If you're on the cusp of retirement, you've been at it all your life, and you're looking at either, you know, taking out a loan and dumping a couple of million dollars into it or saying to heck with it, you know, they're getting out. The other thing is in driving the efficiency is the producers got to get closer to the market. So what you see started in poultry, it's called vertical integration.
Yeah, right.
Where the producers and the processors and the retailers and the consumers, all of that gets integrated and gets closer together.
You minimize overhead that way.
Minimize overhead, have more control over the expenses, have some kind of marketing system that works for the chain, the supply chain, and getting closer to the consumer. And there's a reason that happened in poultry first, because they can turn their genetics quicker. It's less capital. It's happened in the hog industry. I think it's going to continue and be happening more and more in the dairy industry. Beef industry, you're going to see more vertical integration. And some people say they don't want it, but trying to regulate it from happening is actually, in my opinion, causing it to happen. So it's another one of those ironies and that's what I see in American agriculture. Now, there's still going to be niche markets, and I think that's just going to keep growing. I think you're going to see more in organics and natural and local and all of these kinds of things. But you're also going to see the other end of more vertical integration and efficiencies in the American marketplace. Now, in the world, I think we're right in the middle of negotiating, what is it, the Pacific Partner Trade Agreement?
Yeah, I know what you're referring to. I can't call the name up right off the top of my head, but I know what you're referring to.
Well, the point is agriculture is global. we're global now. I mean, look at what has happened with some of the uprisings in the Middle East when the people have cell phones and Twitter and Facebook and stuff. Agriculture is going to be global. Food is global. It's a human issue. It's a noble issue. It's not just in our backyards. It will be global, and our businesses will be global.
It well, I'll tell you what, Tom. We're about at an hour, believe it or not.
Wow, it goes quick, doesn't it?
It does go quick. And I really appreciate you digging into these topics because this is important stuff. I mean, and I love getting sort of the first person perspective, and I really appreciate your expertise and I mean your sincerity about this because we don't understand this process. I think we're starting to more, and if by virtue of our conversation someone gets a better understanding of it, I think we're doing good work here.
Well, we sure love what we do. We believe in it, and I think anyone out there, I've yet to come across anyone that doesn't like to eat. And feeding people is, in my opinion, one of the most noble businesses you can be engaged in, agriculture. So we're very proud to be in this industry. We love our customers. We love the people we work with, and I really enjoyed the talk.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Where can people find you? Where can they find ag professionals? Give us the plugs.
Well, our home office is in Greeley, but you can find us at www.agpros.com.
Fantastic, Tom. Well, I'll tell you what. Thanks for all your work. Thanks for taking the time on a Tuesday here. I know you probably got plenty to do, but continued success to you.
Thank you very much. I love to talk about agriculture, and anytime I get the opportunity, just give me a yell.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
And that'll do it for episode 77 of the John of All Trades podcast. Big thank you to Tom Herron, CEO of AgPros, for talking with me and shedding some light on issues that are important to us all. I hope it increased your understanding. It certainly did mine. And I just thank you for listening. Please check out Tom's website at agpros.com, agpros.com. And while you're going to that website, check out 4Degrees, number 4DEGREES. They're the proud sponsor of the John of All Trades podcast. They've been with us since episode 1, and they do incredible work. So, whoever you're looking to target online, no matter what your business is, 4Degrees can help you reach the consumers and reach the audience that need to see your message better than anyone else, and they will do it very cost effectively. So, 4Degrees, the number 4DEGREES. The John of All Trades podcast is a production of Deft Communications, Denver-based, content, training, engagement. Check us out on the web, deftcom.us. That'll do it. Next Monday, we've got another episode. We stay a little bit rural. We stay outside the city. Great guest coming. Not going to reveal it for you, but you can check it out on Monday. We reveal each week's new episode on Mondays, and go to Facebook and Twitter, JOAT Pod for both. So, until I see you then, say goodnight, crazy.